those of us engaged in this business on a daily basis, we make choices knowing that there's always the risk that it might be the wrong choice.
I mean, there's always a problem, I suppose, if you're a government minister and someone says to you, look, there's information come to us from another source. It may or may not have been obtained by torture, but they're going to blow up half of London tomorrow. What do you do as a minister?
Our understanding of Britain's security services is coloured by myth and make-believe, but this series is about the real spooks.
Intelligence will rarely provide a complete picture. It gives us pieces of a whole. It helps improve our chances of success, but it will not in itself provide certainty.
I've been given extraordinary access and spoken to some of the key figures at the heart of Britain's security establishment. The terrorist threat has posed new challenges. It's also raised difficult questions and exposed some of the moral ambiguities involved in intelligence work. The real nature of the threat to Britain became clear on July the 7th, 2005. This was Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Ian Blair speaking on Radio 4's Today programme early that morning.
London is a terrorist target, and particularly the postcard sites of London have been all along, and it is again that experience.
As he spoke, four men were heading towards the capital, carrying rucksacks. Britain's security chiefs were already gathered in Whitehall that morning to discuss the G8 summit in Scotland. Chris Fox, then president of the Association of Chief Police Officers.
We were meeting in Cobra, the Cabinet Office briefing room, under the auspices of the Home Secretary, when we started to get the first indications of the 7/7 bombs. The first information was coming in on live news feeds and snippets, so we were able to swing into action.
Hi, there's a bus just exploded outside in Tavistock Square, just outside my window.
The Tavistock Square?
Yeah, in London. There's people lying on the ground and everything.
52 people were killed and more than 700 injured. Something like this had been expected for some time, but the bombings were to shine a sometimes uncomfortable spotlight on the security service. Sir Richard Mottram became Security and Intelligence Coordinator and Chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee shortly afterwards.
It wasn't a surprise in the sense that no one had anticipated a homegrown threat of this kind, but I think anticipating it and providing intelligence appreciations of it to ministers is really different to it happening.
The following day, Dame Eliza Manningham-Buller, the head of MI5, gathered together her staff in the canteen of Thames House, their headquarters. She told them that what they feared would happen had happened. At first, the bombers were said to be clean skins, people of whom MI5 had no prior knowledge. But within a few days, a connection emerged with another terrorist group whose conversations had been secretly bugged by MI5 the previous year. Because of the quality, we've dramatised those conversations using court transcripts.
You know, lately I'm thinking, Islam, yeah, is on everyone's lips, yeah? That's definite. I can see it, yeah? They think these guys are something, you know? They're not little poodles that just wave jihad, jihad. They can organise and they can execute operations.
To the max, bro.
And this ideology that's being spread, right, is very powerful. Islam is on everyone's lips, including the politicians. Today, right now, we'll be speaking in MI5 headquarters.
During the thousands of hours of surveillance of Operation Crevice, as it was called, a number of individuals were registered as contacts of the key conspirators. Amongst them was a man, not identified by name at the time, who asked an unusual question of one of the plotters, as we can hear in this dramatisation.
Are you really a terrorist?
They're working with us.
You're serious? You are basically?
I'm not a terrorist, but they're working through us.
Who are? There's no one higher than you.
One of the two men was the ringleader of the Crevice plot. MI5 made a note to investigate the other, but not as a top priority. And then, in the bloody aftermath of the July 7th bombings, they realised who he was, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the ringleader of 7/7. MI5 defended itself by saying that it had too many leads and too few resources to follow them all up. But David Blunkett, Home Secretary at the time of the Crevice investigation, doesn't believe resources were the issue.
I don't think it was a lack of resource in terms of MI5, because we'd said over and over again, do you need more money? Can you recruit more quickly? Is the long-term doubling of the facility that you have enough? And the answer was, well, it'll never be enough, but we can't move any faster than we are. You've got to also remember that people were throwing in all sorts of things at that time. There were literally thousands of potential contacts, because every time you, using TAP or surveillance or information being given to you, every time you have that, there's a snowball effect. So there's all sorts of different leads that flow from it. And part of the intelligence and security services job is to be able to analyse what is and isn't important. And from time to time, they're going to get that slightly wrong.
So did they get something wrong? Peter Clark is the head of the Metropolitan Police Counter-Terrorism Command.
I can understand why people want to know. You know, was this something that could perhaps have been avoided if different decisions, different actions had been taken earlier? I think two things, really. One is hindsight's a wonderful thing, of course. And the second is, I think that reaction actually misses the point. What we're looking at here are networks which are fluid, mobile, interlinked. They morph one into the other. And I would be, in a strange way, more worried if, when an attack happened, the people who had committed it were not in any of our intelligence systems than if they were, because it would have meant we'd been looking at entirely the wrong people.
The controversy has still not gone away. But how can the public be confident that the truth will be uncovered? Whether there were any failures is being investigated for a second time by the Parliamentary Intelligence and Security Committee. The continued debate was clearly what Jonathan Evans, MI5's Director General, had in mind when he gave his first public speech last month.
There will be instances when individuals come to the notice of the security service or the police, but then subsequently carry out acts of terrorism. This is inevitable. Every decision to investigate someone entails a decision not to investigate someone else.
A key question the Intelligence and Security Committee is looking at is cooperation between MI5 and the police. We do know that Mohammed Sadiq Khan was photographed and followed back to his home in West Yorkshire, but MI5 say there was nothing to indicate that he was likely to carry out an attack in the future. But did MI5 inform the local police so they could follow up if necessary? The committee is due to report in the coming weeks, but its critics have argued that it lacks the weight and resources to provide sufficient oversight and maintain public confidence. Committee Chairman Paul Murphy, MP.
Well, I don't want to comment on the detail of that because we're still in our stage of investigating, except to say to you, of course, that is a very important area we're looking at. We do know that MI5 informed West Yorkshire Police. What we've now done in the committee is to look at the detail behind all that, and we'll obviously report when that comes out, but it is an issue.
Do you give the head of MI5 a hard time when you're in a committee? What's it like?
I think we do give them a hard time, yes. We're not rude to them. You know, some of my parliamentarian colleagues in certain committees are quite robust, shall we say. But I think people just have to take my word that there is really no difference in the way in which we work in private than our counterparts meet in public. The only difference may be that now and again, some of the members take their jackets off.
Although an attack had long been anticipated, what did cause alarm in the wake of 7/7 was that the perpetrators were homegrown and willing to blow themselves up. There was also shock as security chiefs realised just how many others were moving through radicalisation towards violence. Sir Richard Mottram, former chair of the Joint Intelligence Committee, which oversees the work of the intelligence agencies.
Once it had happened, I think we needed to think through what it meant. And the fact that these were UK British citizens did really bring the system up with a jolt and had serious implications for what we were trying to do.
What were those implications, the fact that it was homegrown?
Well, because if it's a homegrown threat, you can't think about it as people had thought about it, which is, if we could, and this has rather been the strategy, I think, of the United States, if we can keep the terrorists away from our borders, if we can, in a sense, seal ourselves off from this problem, then we've solved the problem. Once you recognise it's your own citizens, you have to think about your strategy in a different way, and you have to put much more emphasis on what is leading them to this and how might you seek to influence individuals and communities away from that path inside your own country.
As the nature of the so-called homegrown threat became clear, MI5 realised they needed to step up efforts to reach into communities. That meant working more closely with the police, so close now as to be almost indistinguishable.
You can't anymore tell who's the cop, who's the spook. I think that's probably the test.
Mike Todd is the chief constable of Greater Manchester Police, which was the first to set up their own counter-terrorism unit. It's headed by Detective Chief Superintendent Tony Porter.
This is effectively a newly kitted out floor. I'll just walk and talk you through, but what you will see is our analysts, indexers. There's officers here that are involved in coordinating work that's related to prisons throughout the Northwest.
Radicalisation in prisons.
Radicalisation. Officers involved in counter-terrorism at community level. One of the differences is that the security service are adept at intelligence acquisition. What the police bring to the party is the reach into the communities.
We have our separate roles.
Chief Constable Mike Todd.
The security services are the national lead for counter-terrorism. They do all the liaison with foreign intelligence services, and then we get a sort of sanitised product through for us to take action against it. But, you know, when you actually look now, we are so joined up, working in such an integrated way now. And yes, we do the same things. You know, we both carry out technical surveillance. You know, we both carry out physical surveillance. We both run agents and informants.
Right, over here, this is our surveillance area. These guys here act as the planners, the researchers. So if we want to do a surveillance operation on a target, these guys will look at the target. They will start to develop the support for the surveillance teams. They'll advise the surveillance teams on what they require. And then they will deliver a package to the management to say, well, if you want to do surveillance on X, this is what you need to provide it.
Is it like in the films?
Surveillance officers have got my greatest respect. It's a damn difficult job, can be extremely boring, and on other moments can be extremely interesting. Tim. These gentlemen from Radio 4, okay. They were just talking about gizmos in terms of technical assets that we use to support surveillance. Now, I suspect there's probably not a great deal we'd be prepared to talk about.
Not really, no. Usual stuff, cameras, and it's just size and scale, really, that we try and keep to ourselves.
Yeah.
Because that's where the protection is, I suppose. Isn't
yeah.
It?
I mean, Tim is our detective inspector that oversees all our surveillances, our technical guru as well. I'd have been very disappointed if it had told you any
exactly
of our gizmos. That's actually a test he's passed.
When you look at the link between the service and the police, it reaches literally from the Director General of the Security Service, the chief constable, right the way down to a community police officer working in one of our communities.
Just walk this way. I'll just show you the squad rooms. Probably the size of the office space they had 6 months ago was a quarter of this. And this is going to increase and increase as we get more and more assets in. So it's just an indication. And I'm delighted to say there's nobody here, because you'll never guess where they all are.
Where are they?
They're on surveillance.
You're not going to tell me where they're on surveillance, though,
no,
are you?
No, not at all.
It's very busy. I have to say, I think when it comes to the sort of tasking, coordinating meeting every week between the police service nationally and the security service, there's no shortage of targets that we've got to deal with.
At a local level, the police are devoting more and more people to counter-terrorism, partly so they can investigate the intelligence MI5 is providing. Without such an increase, the fear, as one senior officer put it to me, was another Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the ghost that haunts them.
So, this is effectively the hub where investigations sit. We work on covert investigations. So we get an intelligence feed from the security service. We will have desk officers that start to develop it. It will get to a point where we're considering arrest or some kind of disruption. The requirements then start to focus more on the requirements that the courts might have. So these guys are trained, the specialist, in migrating covert intelligence into overt evidence.
It's not just the police. MI5 have also fanned out across the country, opening 8 regional stations. By 2011, it's projected that a quarter of their staff will work outside of the capital. MI5 is also in the process of building what it calls an operating centre outside of London to allow the rapid response of surveillance and other officers. The exact location is secret. The expansion into the regions is a recognition that some of the most valuable intelligence comes from communities. Sir David Omond, former security and intelligence coordinator.
Preemptive intelligence comes from two sources. It's either going to come from deploying all the professional tricks of the trade of the intelligence community, or it's going to come from within the community, because they reject the extremists and they're prepared to identify those who are going off track or falling victim to radicalization. And they'll only do that if they have confidence in the integrity of the security authorities and indeed in the protection that the state as a whole will afford their community.
Both the police and MI5 are now trying to catch early signs of suspicious activity, and they've developed a project called Rich Picture, designed to monitor what's going on inside communities. But there is perhaps a fine line between knowing what's going on and intrusive intelligence gathering, or spying. Peter Clark, head of the Metropolitan Police Counter-Terrorism Command.
I don't think there's a tension between spying, as you put it, and liaising. I think the public recognise that we are police officers looking to carry out our duty of keeping them safe and enforcing the law. And I don't think there's a conflict there. They have to really recognise that what we're doing is working on their behalf. Counterterrorism is something that you do with and for communities. It's not something you should be doing to communities.
One of the major concerns of the security services, as the director of MI5 made clear in his recent speech, is the radicalisation of the young. 15 and 16-year-olds are being targeted. The police want to be able to spot this early and stop it. Chief Constable Mike Todd.
If you had a child who was likely to be involved in burglary, so let's take it out of counterterrorism just for a second, wouldn't you far rather that the police, the state, social services, whoever it was, wrapped a package around and said, look, we don't want you getting involved in crime. That's far better than waiting till they've committed that crime and then them getting a criminal conviction and police kicking down the front door at 5 o'clock in the morning. And it's the same thing with counterterrorism. We've got to provide that reassurance to communities that actually we want to stop this in the first place.
When do we want it? No. What do we want? Justice. When do we want it?
Community relations suffered a major setback in June 2006, a year after the London bombings. Acting on intelligence, police raided a house in Forest Gate in East London. Two men were arrested, one of them was shot. But officers found nothing, despite lurid headlines about a possible chemical device. The Met was forced to apologise, and both men were released without charge.
I apologise for the hurt that we may have caused. In tackling the terrorist threat in the United Kingdom, the police service is trying its utmost to work closely with all communities, and in particular, the Muslim community.
We've got to take risk. We're trying to manage risk all the time.
The man who made the decision to go ahead with the raid was Peter Clark.
So when we get intelligence like that, we test it, we retest it, we try to cross-check it, we try to coordinate it, we do everything we possibly can.
And you don't feel let down by the security service, whoever might have provided intelligence, which doesn't work out?
No, far from it, because in all these cases, there is joint working leading up to the point where the police would take action. It is not the case that intelligence just lands in our laps and then we go out and act on it. We're not going to go out and conduct operations which inevitably will have a significant impact on the community if we're not absolutely sure that it's necessary to do so.
Now, many accept that even if the decision to raid the house was justifiable, the tactics, using large numbers of armed officers, may have been wrong. Sir Richard Mottram.
This was an operational decision taken by the police, and the way in which they chose to go about it reflected operational experience in other cases. Now, it didn't turn out that well. Shall we say, which is sort of civil service-y speak, but they acted in good faith. But from that, I think, they learned some important lessons about both how you'd handle an individual operation, but also about how you would engage with the local community when you were engaged in such a thing.
I can recall one operation that we were running just after Forest Gate, where we actually said, hang on a minute, none of the intelligence said these people have firearms, so we don't need to run a firearms operation. We did some lifestyle work and said, well, actually, you know, these people, because of the nature of their occupations, we could arrest them away from their home address and then execute the warrants later on, you know, in a different way. It doesn't have to be a big, necessarily, a big set piece, oh, we're going in with firearms, we're doing that. So I think you've just sometimes got to understand the nature of the community, understand the risk that your officers face as well, and then plan appropriately.
Mike Todd, Chief Constable of Greater Manchester. Forest Gate showed the need for reliable intelligence from good sources, people providing information. We've been given a document which provides a unique insight into how MI5 might approach people. It concerns the case of a man called Abu Anas.
Subject: Meeting with Abu Anas, 31st of October 2002.
The document given to us by the man's lawyer has been partially redacted or censored, but appears to be a memo written by an MI5 officer who paid a visit to the home of Abu Anas in northwest London.
This is a reasonably well-maintained 1930s semi, probably worth around £300,000, if the local estate agent's window is anything to go by. Parked on the drive at the front was a small silver-coloured car displaying a green L-plate. Anas opened the door himself. In Arabic, I introduced us as Michael from the British government and Andy from Scotland Yard, and asked if we could have a brief chat with him.
The officers were interested in his relationship with Abu Qatada, a radical London-based cleric who has been linked with Al-Qaeda. They believed that Abu Anas was his financier.
I explained that Andy was from Scotland Yard and that I was from the Mukhabarat, the intelligence service, although it was important for him to understand that we were not like the Mukhabarat in most Arab countries. I told him that in addition to increased focus on UK-based extremists, we were investigating reports of terrorists based abroad who were keen to mount attacks in the UK.
MI5 and the police wanted information, and they offered Abu Anas a choice.
I continued, saying that in the event of a successful attack in the UK, it was not possible to predict the government's reaction. It was quite possible that he could find himself swept up in a further round of detentions. He did, however, have a choice. He could continue with his current life, or... At this point, he interrupted to ask what I meant by his current life. I told him that I meant his association with members of the extremist community. I returned to the choice which he could make. If he chose to help us by providing details of all his activities and contacts, we would assist him to create a new life for himself and his family.
Anas did not agree to help MI5. He flew to Gambia a few days later, where he was arrested and handed over to the Americans. He ended up in Guantanamo Bay. MI5 say they did not expect the Americans to do this. The case of Abu Anas, or to use his real name, Jamil Al-Banna, shines a light on relations between the intelligence services of Britain and the United States. Philip Mudd is a senior counter-terrorism official at the FBI.
First, you have a target that threatens both of us so intimately. So I think the tactical cooperation extensively across our services is probably greater than it has been in the past. But also we're looking at things like how we train people, how we develop people in intelligence careers, how we handle data. So it's not only cooperation tactically against on individual cases, it's also cooperation on how we do business.
How intense is the sharing of information? How close is that relationship?
I think the word you used is appropriate, and that is intense. We're not really allies, we're really brothers in arms.
After 9/11, the Americans took a tough new line. British citizen Mohsin Beg was picked up by them in Afghanistan shortly afterwards. He claims officers from MI5 were a regular presence.
I'm fairly sure that MI5 were present right from my incarceration in Islamabad, Pakistan in 2002, all the way through to my incarceration in Guantanamo Bay. The MI5 as ghosts appeared and reappeared almost, materialising at various points. The first time that I was interrogated by MI5 in Afghanistan, I was brought into the tent with my head hooded, my hands shackled, and two huge soldiers frog marching me into the room, almost into a bowing position, forced onto my knees. And one of the British agents said quite lamely, "Is that all necessary?" To which the response was a terse yes. And then they left the room, and the British intelligence guys just asked me a few questions. "How are you, mate? Look what we brought you here from England." It was a Mars bar that they put on the table. And they began with that whatever you do, if you want to get out of this situation, you have to cooperate with the Americans. That's the only way that you can get out from here.
Britain has sometimes found cooperating with the Americans problematic. Practices like rendition, tough interrogation techniques like waterboarding, and secret prisons in other countries known as black sites, all of these raise difficult moral questions. How closely should Britain's security agencies ally themselves with the Americans? Sir Richard Mottram was, until last month, the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee.
They think about the problem differently. They express themselves about it, somewhat differently. They have chosen to use some approaches which we wouldn't use. Therefore, we have to shape our cooperation in the context of our understanding of international law. And we've shaped it in the context, I think, of our understanding of how best to tackle counterterrorism.
Dealing with an international threat can lead MI5 onto difficult ethical terrain. I've been told by Pakistani intelligence officers that when they pick up a suspect of interest to the UK, British officials are allowed to watch the interrogation take place on video monitors in a neighbouring room. A suspect is unlikely to be mistreated while they're there, but there are times when MI5 may get information which could be the result of torture. Sir David Omond, former security and intelligence coordinator.
Intelligence doesn't come like pots of jam with labels and health warnings. It comes as telephone numbers or addresses or suggestions that you might follow up a particular line of inquiry. And were you to ask, you probably wouldn't be told. So the issue for the UK authorities, for our authorities, is if you receive intelligence which looks as if it bears on the security of people living here, you have a duty to follow it up. And that's the line I think the judges have also taken.
There is ultimately, I think, no way around a very awkward question that if information of that kind became available and you could have confidence in it, what would you do with it? But that's perhaps a different question to, does the British government support information being obtained in ways which are out with our understanding of international law and the laws that apply to our intelligence agencies? And the British government does not support such action.
Sir Richard Mottram. Paul Murphy, chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee and a former Northern Ireland minister, sympathises with those who have to take these decisions.
I mean, there's always a problem, I suppose, if you're a government minister and someone says to you, look, there's information come to us from another source. It may or may not have been obtained by torture, but they're going to blow up half of London tomorrow. What do you do as a minister?
It's not just the security of the general public. MI5 also have to concern themselves with the potential vulnerability of Britain's infrastructure, an issue brought sharply into focus last year.
All passengers must be hand-searched, and their footwear and all items they are carrying must be X-ray screened.
Last summer there was chaos here at Heathrow, with the airport being brought to a near standstill, queues snaking around the block, people unsure what they could take on as hand luggage. It all came after the security services disrupted what they believed was a major plot.
Any liquids discovered must be removed from the passenger. We will not be permitting bottled liquids and fluids.
Since 9/11, MI5 has had to develop closer relationships with business, providing intelligence and security advice through regular contact. Ian Hutchison is the head of security at Heathrow.
Well, they will look for holes. They will actually make sure that if we're going to invest in physical security as well as technology, that we actually invest in the right things to actually deflect whatever threat it is we're seeking to deflect.
And I suppose it takes their knowledge of what that threat is and how terrorists operate to see what the potential weak points might be.
Yeah, it will also be their own knowledge within the security service or their knowledge of experts who can actually provide that.
It's not just airports. Hospitals, train stations, power stations are all potential targets, and are all dependent on regular security advice from the new Centre for the Protection of National Infrastructure. Adam Mellalure is the head of security for the National Grid.
I mean, the relationship is the same as any other relationship. We talk on the phone, we meet face-to-face, we sit on similar fora, we exchange emails. If it's specific, we'll meet on site to discuss specific issues. We might speak daily, we might speak weekly. As a company, we're certainly speaking, you know, on a very regular basis.
They certainly spoke back in 2004 when the Crevice plotters discussed targeting utilities, as we can hear from this dramatisation of surveillance.
The resources from this country
the electricity, the gas, going into the alarm engineers, stuff like this, yeah? That, I'm saying, is good. Get brothers in each and every field, from the gas to the electric to the water to the alarm engineers, everything.
How much does it worry you when you get some specific piece of intelligence? This group is talking about attacking National Grid or something like that. Does that happen often? Is it worrying?
Well, I mean, any information about you being targeted is worrying. I think it's part of the whole suite of measures you put in place. Intelligence is one of the components of that. So you do need to have a relationship with an intelligence service that can actually provide you information up front.
The gathering tide of attacks and attempted attacks has continued into this year, putting pressure on the security services and the police. The 28-day limit for holding suspects before charge has become a controversial political issue. Peter Clark, the head of the Met's Counter-Terrorist Command, believes that there may be occasions in the future where they do need more time.
What I do find slightly frustrating are the occasions when in the debate which is going on about whether there should be extended detention pre-charge or not, the suggestion's been made by some people that if we had longer to make those investigations before we had to charge or release, that this would merely encourage what's been termed lazy policing, or that the police would work more slowly. I find that absolutely disgraceful as an allegation to make, and I'm sorry that it has been made by some people.
Could you give us a sense of the scale?
Well, when we're talking about links which are literally global, where we have to make investigations across the world in almost every single case, where we have hundreds of pieces of computer material, whether it be hard drives, removable storage or whatever, when we're dealing with multiple identities, many of them false. This is new. I know it's being suggested in some quarters that it's not, but it is.
The global nature of terrorist investigations means a contact in Birmingham can quickly lead to Pakistan. This has meant that all of Britain's intelligence agencies have had to set aside old rivalries and work closely together. MI6, Britain's overseas service, works with foreign partners to pursue and generate leads. GCHQ listens into conversations around the world and analyses online activity, trying to piece together links between suspects. This joint working has proved vital. Sir Richard Mottram.
Virtually every plot of significance has both a domestic and an international dimension. And both the domestic and the international dimension need to be pursued together. And in order to do that, you've got to have a clear understanding of who's in the lead, and you've got to orchestrate together the way in which the three agencies work. And generally speaking, this has worked well with the security service quite clearly in the lead. And the habit of cooperation in the intelligence agencies has definitely developed their mutual confidence, their mutual trust. And I think that this is a success. Because although it seems quite an easy thing to do, if you look internationally, there's quite a lot of rivalry between intelligence agencies in other countries. And although there's some rivalry here, which is probably basic to esprit de corps, I've not seen it get in the way of the effective handling of operations.
Last month, MI5's Director General talked of 2,000 known suspects and warned of perhaps as many again not yet identified. To keep pace, MI5 is also growing fast. Within a few months, it will have nearly doubled in size since 9/11, and it will keep growing beyond then as it seeks to recruit everyone from intelligence officers to car mechanics. A recent radio campaign was for surveillance officers.
Want to stand out from the crowd but be invisible? If you're better at seeing than being seen, then you could join MI5 as a mobile surveillance officer. You'll use your patience, observational skills and judgment, and we'll give you all the training you need. Intelligence. We rely on yours.
By 2011, MI5 will have 4,000 staff. MI5 has transformed itself in the last few years, but how big should it be? If we wanted a security service that followed every lead, winkled out every fact, it might stop more attacks, but it could become oppressive. A word of caution from the woman who ran MI5 in the 1990s, Stella Rimmington.
You could have an enormous security service if you wanted every single threat to be investigated and negated. If you did that, you'd end up like the East German Stasi, where everybody, you know, was recruited as a source and children were spying on their parents and all that sort of thing. And nobody would want that in a democracy.
It's not just the growth of MI5, it's also new tools and technologies like DNA databases and data mining, which will offer greatly increased power when it comes to finding out things about people. Sir David Omond, former Security and Intelligence Coordinator, acknowledges this raises serious questions.
The big issues, I think, that will come up over the next few years are less to do with scale and more to do with what personal privacies are we prepared to allow to be compromised in return for greater security. The arguments over joining up of databases, the ability of modern information technology to join up the dots. These are very powerful tools, and it is certain in my mind that these are the tools that the intelligence community needs to be able to use. But as society, we have to be rather careful to limit the purposes for which such high-capacity, intrusive investigation can be used.
As MI5 grows, the challenge will be ensuring that public confidence and accountability are not left behind. But both MI5 and the police warn that the worst may be yet to come. Peter Clark of Scotland Yard and MI5 Director General Jonathan Evans.
You can never say that you have enough to meet a threat which is as broad and as deep as this threat is.
We'll do our utmost to hold back the physical threat of attacks, but alone this is merely containment.
Britain's security services warn that this is a struggle likely to last for generations. It's also one that the spooks alone cannot win. Their task is to work in the shadows. But the question for the rest of us is how much latitude we give them, whilst protecting liberty for ourselves.